From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Margaret Drabble's early novels predate the contemporary feminist movement. She made a name for herself writing introspective, semi-autobiographical novels about the career and family choices faced by women. On today's Fresh Air, Drabble tells us why she doesn't want to write that kind of novel anymore. Also, film director Harold Becker talks about his new hit, Sea of Love, starring Al Pacino and Ellen Barkin. Stephen Schiff reviews An Innocent Man, starring Tom Selleck. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Marian Anderson's operatic debut in 1955. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A group of about 50 activists, mostly women, are occupying the Costa Rican embassy in El Salvador today. The activists, who say they are unarmed, are protesting what they claim is an upsurge in state repression. Riot police have surrounded the office building but made no attempt to enter the Costa Rican mission occupied by the group of mothers and relatives of disappeared persons. The group is holding the Costa Rican ambassador. More than 600 East German refugees left Warsaw, Poland today on a train that's bound for the West. A growing number of East Germans have been seeking passage through Poland since Czechoslovakia closed its borders to them on Monday. Jane Dobia has details from Warsaw.
A diplomat from the West German embassy in Warsaw accompanied the refugees, hopefully guaranteeing their safe passage through East German borders. One 27-year-old woman who was on the train admitted being afraid. She swam into Poland this morning via the Odra River. "I have no baggage," she said, "no underwear or socks or even shoes. But," she added, "I do have a good head on my shoulders and a good pair of hands." Last Sunday, a trainload of 800 refugees left Warsaw. The flow of emigres shows no signs of stopping. Today, Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa blamed East Germany's economic and political system for citizens' dissatisfaction. "If all the borders were opened right now," Wałęsa said, "there probably would be no one left to turn off the lights." For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Tibet's exiled Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for 1989. The exiled ruler has advocated a nonviolent struggle against Chinese domination of his homeland. The Nobel Committee announced that prize today in Oslo, Norway. China immediately accused the committee of meddling in China's internal affairs. By a vote of 91-9, the United States Senate today approved a flag protection bill. The measure has already been passed by the House of Representatives and now goes to the president for his signature. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
President Bush went to the Iwo Jima Marine Memorial to call for a constitutional amendment to overturn last summer's Supreme Court decision throwing out the conviction of a flag burner. The court cited the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech in declaring the anti-flag desecration law unconstitutional. Public outcry against the decision convinced members of both parties this could be a hot political issue, which the president quickly moved to take advantage of by calling for an amendment. Some members of Congress responded they were hesitant to tamper with the First Amendment, but Democrats are wary of this issue, feeling it can be used against them the way Michael Dukakis' veto of a Pledge of Allegiance bill was used in the last presidential campaign. Both houses instead have passed a simple statute to protect the flag, which they hope will meet constitutional muster. But the Senate Democratic leadership also promised to bring an amendment to the floor later this year, and once politicians are forced to publicly take a stand on it, a constitutional amendment is likely to succeed.
This is NPR in Washington. Jesse Jackson will be hitting the airwaves on a regular basis beginning sometime next year. Jackson and Warner Brothers television executives announced today that the two-time presidential candidate will host a weekly syndicated television talk show. The one-hour show will be called Voices of America with Jesse Jackson. Jackson says he'll use his international contacts to interview world leaders of all viewpoints. In addition, Jackson says he'll talk to non-political figures not usually seen on American television. French President François Mitterrand today proposed a European Community war on drugs and praised the Bush administration's campaign against drug traffickers. Mitterrand announced his proposal at the annual Franco-Italian summit in Venice. Sylvia Pagioli has more from Rome.
The Mitterrand plan to combat drug trafficking calls for the creation of a small special group with one representative each of the 12 European Community countries. Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti told a joint news conference this afternoon that Italy welcomes the French proposal aimed at coordinating and harmonizing the battle against drugs. Asked if he had been inspired by President Bush's declaration of war on drugs, Mitterrand said that what is good about the Bush plan is that it tackles the problem from all sides, against producers and traffickers, before any repression of users. On other issues, the two leaders called for more aid to Poland and Hungary and voiced backing for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's Arab-Israeli peace plan. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
The man directing the federal effort to assist victims of Hurricane Hugo defended his agency today. Grant Peterson, the associate director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, said that although FEMA has been stretched to its limit, much has been done and the government will continue working until the storm is just a bad memory. Peterson said the agency could not begin its response until governors asked for a presidential disaster declaration. But once that was done, FEMA called in the Defense Department for assistance and immediately took action. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Margaret Drabble is one of the most respected novelists in her native England. She was one of the first women novelists to write about the dilemmas of career and family faced by contemporary women. As Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood puts it, Drabble was one of the first writers to take women's domestic life, the diapers, the dishes, the rashes, and treat it as subject matter suitable for literature. Drabble has written 11 novels since 1963, including The Garrick Year, The Needle's Eye, The Ice Age, and The Middle Ground. She spent the first half of the 1980s editing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, and then she returned to fiction. The two books she's written since, The Radiant Way and A Natural Curiosity, are about the same characters, three middle-aged professional women living in contemporary England. I asked Margaret Drabble if she's been trying new things and writing in a new voice since her return to fiction.
Yes, I think I have. One of the reasons for the gap was that I was rather tired with what I had been doing. I thought I'd come to the end of a particular vein, and I wanted to write a different kind of book. I wasn't sure whether I was able to, but I wanted to have a go.
What kinds of differences were you looking for?
Well, I wanted to write a less interior, more exterior book. I wanted to write a book that jumped around a lot. I was tired of looking deep into the psyches of characters, and I was tired of the introspective novel, I suppose. And I was also tired of the domestic novel. The novel that I published in 1980, The Middle Ground, is a very domestic novel, although it reaches out from its domestic centre. And I wanted to write a book that was simply more mobile.
Why were you tired of writing in such an introspective voice?
I think because I'd done all the introspection I needed to do. I'd sort of solved all the problems. And there was nothing more in there that I wanted to say. I was much more interested, which I think is very common at my age, in what was going on around me than in worrying and angst about my own life and problems.
So, A Natural Curiosity, it strikes me, for instance, is more about the evil side of human nature, in a way. Why that exists? What are we to make of it? Can we change it? Is there a way of getting around it?
Yes, it's a more abstract question, and it comes up in the book in many forms, some of them sort of fairly black comic forms. But it's not an interior book. It's asking a question about the whole of human nature, if you like.
Well, one of your characters, a woman, visits a serial murderer repeatedly, and this murderer killed one of her students. Can you explain her preoccupation with trying to understand him?
Well, yes. I mean, it seems to me a very natural curiosity, which is why I gave the book its title, because I find it very hard, as Alex Byrne in the novel finds it hard, to believe that people enjoy murdering people, and that I also find it hard to believe that psychotic characters are evil. I think it's much more likely that something went wrong with a connection somewhere in childhood. And Alex, of course, during the novel, is interested, indeed sort of obsessed with proving that this is the case, that he didn't commit the murders out of evil. Because when you see him, he, like many serial murderers, is a mild, quiet-looking young man who looks as though he wouldn't hurt a fly. So she's interested in the enigma of this kind of personality.
I think the other side is taken by a character named Brian, who thinks that you know, Terry Waite really shouldn't have tried to free the hostages. He says, why can't people accept the limitations of the human condition instead of trying to show off all the time?
That's quite right. Absolutely. And I think these are two contrasting positions. I think it's also fair to say that Alex wasn't trying to show off. I mean, she does her prison visiting quite modestly and secretly. She doesn't go around saying that she is a martyr,
What about just accepting the limitations of the human condition?
I don't think that's possible.
You don't think it's possible?
No, I don't. I think that Brian would like to think it's possible, but it's not. One has to keep looking.
Mm-hmm.
One has to keep looking for explanations. That's why we're here, or one of the reasons why we're here. It's certainly one of the reasons why I think I'm here, is to ask questions for which there are no answers.
Novelist Margaret Drabble is my guest. Her new book is called A Natural Curiosity. You know, getting back to the 7-year hiatus that you took from fiction, I found myself looking to The Middle Ground, your novel right before the hiatus, for some clues to why you stopped writing fiction for a while. And I'd like to just read one paragraph from that novel. And this paragraph describes some of the reasons why a woman who's a journalist feels she's suddenly facing both a midlife crisis and professional restlessness. The area which she had made her own seemed ever more confining. What had seemed unexplored terrain became well-trodden as more and more women began to write about menstruation, battered wives, low career expectations for girls. In short, as the women's movement gathered momentum, she found herself trapped in stale repetition and depressed by the fact that as everyone else got more interested in women, she became less and less so. The feeling of deep boredom which overcame her when she opened a woman's novel frightened her.
Yes.
Did that describe how you were feeling at the time?
Well, I mean, that's a parody of how I was feeling. But, yes, obviously some of that feeling I recognise very much, that what had seemed fresh and interesting is becomes familiar. And when everybody's doing it, you're glad they're doing it. You're glad that these topics are sort of constantly presented for public discussion, but you don't want to go on doing it yourself. You yourself feel you've done that bit, it's time to move on. And I think this is a very normal feeling. Also, I'd like to point out that the character in the novel, Kate, is a journalist with a weekly column, so every week she has to find a subject to bang on about, and she's finding this a bit tedious. I think it's probably more difficult to write a weekly column than to write a novel.
But with you now, you had written about women's lives in your novels, and the territory you wrote was being covered by other women as you get older. Now, you published your first novel in 62 or 63.
Yeah.
But did you start feeling like the territory was becoming more confining with the arrival of more women novelists, more serious women novelists?
I suppose I felt that the territory was becoming overtrodden. And that particular kind of novel I no longer wanted to write. Other people were writing it. I had written mine, and mine were there on the shelf. I mean, I haven't unwritten them. They still stand there, and they probably speak to women in their 30s as they did when I was in my 30s. In fact, I know they do because people tell me so. But I knew that for me there was something else that I ought to be doing. It's as though you hand on the torch. That sounds a bit grandiose and pompous, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, your character in The Middle Ground expresses not only her boredom with women's novels, but her horror at the commercialization of the feminist novel.
Uh-huh.
Were you finding that too, the commercialization of the feminist novel?
Well, yes, I mean, I do find this disturbing. I find the whole idea of being a professional feminist rather worrying. And there's something in the publishing industry and the media, as soon as they discover something, you know, it's women's novels or it's the Latin American novel or it's magic realism. And I find that uncomfortable. I don't want to pander to a kind of trivialization and commercialization of something that I take very seriously. I don't like the idea that I, as a woman novelist, should support all other women novelists, regardless of whether I think they're any good or not. And that is certainly a feeling you get in some parts of the so-called feminist movement.
Were these sentiments ever uncomfortable for you to admit to?
No, not at all. I'm delighted to admit to them.
Mm-hmm.
Other people don't like them, but I don't feel ashamed of them at all. I think they should feel ashamed of themselves, myself.
Although you have been an important writer for many feminist readers and writers, I'm wondering if you identified with the feminist movement. You started writing in the early 60s, and you had started to establish yourself before the renaissance of the feminist movement in the late 60s.
That's right. I predate it, and some of my books were its raw material. And I have been processed, and sometimes I'm not entirely happy with the processing. I mean, I can process my own work.
What do you mean you've been processed?
Well, people have interpreted my work in ways and presented it to the public in ways that I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, people are at liberty to do this, of course, that's fine, but I'm at liberty to say that's not quite what I meant, and anyway, I'm now off to do something else, thank you very much.
Oh, you're saying that you haven't seen your novels as feminist novels?
Oh, not at all. I don't think I'm the same kind of feminist that the feminists are who are picking up my points. I think there are many versions of feminism. I think that life is an extremely complex business, and that one of the points of writing novels is to show that it is complicated, and that if you write a scene in which a woman asks her husband to start the car on a frosty morning because she can't get it going, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a bad cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a good cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. It's the simplification of feminist criticism which sometimes irritates me, and I try to get my characters to edge pretty quickly out of the pigeonholes that people are trying to put them into. Because to me, the confusion, the muddle, the struggling between ideology and reality is what makes a novel and life real and interesting.
I've read that your mother was a feminist, and I was wondering in what respect.
She was a feminist in that she read Bernard Shaw and The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, and she believed that women should be educated, and she thought it was disgraceful to spend more on educating your sons than your daughters. And she would have liked a career had society permitted her to have one. She was a teacher, but when she married, as happened in those days, she had to leave her job. When the war broke out and the men were called up, she went back to her job as a teacher. When the war ended, she was dismissed again. And this made her rather a vocal feminist at times. But she wasn't a very effective one because society didn't permit her to be so. And also she became very embittered. I think that hatred and embitteredness, if that's a word, are dangerous for people. They make them very unhappy and they make them ineffective at the same time.
But since she was fighting for rights for women, you know, personally, did you grow up just taking that for granted that women should be equal and that women could work?
Well, life is never as simple as that. I mean, we grew up taking it for granted that women were intellectually equal. There was no suggestion in our household that they weren't, and it would have been inappropriate if they had been, because we were clever girls, you know, we were scholarship girls. It was obvious that we were equal intellectually. But when it actually came to the job market and to having careers, of course it became much, much more opaque and confused, as my mother's life had been. She wanted us, I think, to marry and have babies. She didn't want us to do it as soon as we did. We married and had babies to get away from her. And life is not, you know, not clear. And looking back, one looks back again and again, as my character Liz Headland looks back in a natural curiosity for the skeletons in your family cupboard. And although I can honestly say that my mother was a feminist, I can also honestly say that she probably wasn't a very good influence in some respects.
Like what?
The image she gave of domestic life was negative. She didn't like other people. She was, as I said, embittered and never saw that she herself could take those steps that would alter her life. She never took them. She prided herself on her domestic life, which she made into a sort of prison for herself, which was contradictory to her theory, but is in practice what she did.
I'm surprised that your reaction wasn't to see domestic life as a prison and avoid it yourself, instead of having babies at such a young age.
Well, I did both. I mean, I both had babies at a young age, and I saw what I was doing as a prison, and then I got out of it. I mean, I think what had happened was that my generation of women in the late 50s and early 60s, we'd been told by our mothers, many of whom were emancipated, I mean, there was emancipation before the 1960s, that we should go to college, that we could have jobs, and also we could be fulfilled women and we could have babies too. I mean, the sort of spinster profession of the 1930s was no longer the model for us. We were going to do everything. And we tried to do everything, and then we realised that doing everything was exhausting. And out of this sense of exhaustion and conflict and competition with ourselves rose the woman's novel, then rose feminist literary theory and the women's movement itself, out of this ideal that we couldn't realise.
I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. The British novelist Margaret Drabble is my guest, and her new novel is called A Natural Curiosity. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Margaret Drabble is my guest. You started out in theater before you wrote, and one of the things that's always mentioned about your early theater days is that you understudied Vanessa Redgrave in a production of Cymbeline.
That's right.
How serious were you about acting, and what were your insecurities, if you had any, about that profession?
I was very serious about being an actress, and I think if I hadn't had children so quickly, I would be an actress now, in that I think I could have earned my living. I wasn't a very varied actress. I was rather a heavyweight, but I certainly was being offered work. But then with children, it became increasingly difficult and increasingly unattractive, and I began to see that this wasn't going to work, really. Acting as a profession is a very unsatisfactory way of life. It's an unsatisfactory lifestyle. And I began to see there were ways where I could have more control over what I was doing.
How did you start writing?
Well, I wrote my first novel while I was still an actress. And I wrote it in the evenings. I wasn't acting at the time. My first husband was at the Royal Shakespeare Company at Stratford, and I was pregnant, expecting my first baby, and I wrote my first novel in the evenings then. And I did it really just to give myself something to do.
When you were in your 20s, a young mother, did you think of yourself as writing about women in a way that women hadn't much written about before in fiction?
I don't think I was conscious of it. I just wrote about what was there. And it was only when the books were published and people began to tell me what they were about that I realised that perhaps there wasn't all that much written about this particular social phenomenon, the young graduate mother. I remember I went to Paris on a travel grant in 1966, when I had three young children, and I took the three young children with me, of course. I mean, that's what I did. And I remember my publishers, my French publishers and my English publishers, sort of saying, who did I want to meet in Paris? And I said, well, I'd like to meet young women writers of about my own age. And there weren't any. There just weren't any. I mean, the woman's novel hadn't been invented in France. There was a long hiatus. And there just weren't any people like me. Whereas in England, there were beginning to be people like me.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, we were talking earlier about how you felt that the feminist novel had become commercialized, and that the subjects you had been exploring were already being explored by so many people once, I guess, we hit the 1970s. Was your initial feeling when more women started writing fiction, when there were more feminist novels, one of companionship, of being glad to be able to share the field with other women?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it was very exciting to find that, and there were other people doing it. And I still feel that. I mean, some of my best friends are women novelists.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to differentiate between those who are jumping on the bandwagon and those who are doing it for real. And I think there is a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm not going to name the names of those who I think jump on the bandwagon, but I could list a long list of women writers, starting with Doris Lessing and coming down to Mary Gordon, who I think are writing wonderful fiction.
Mm-hmm. Let's move up ahead in time a little bit. While you were taking your hiatus from fiction and writing, editing the Oxford Companion to Literature, did you find it a relief to be writing nonfiction and to be writing short biography?
Yes, I did. I thought it was a relief to be doing something constructive, by which I mean that at the end of every day I'd covered more paper and I'd put another little piece into the jigsaw. I'd done another letter of the alphabet. Well, actually, that's not true, because a letter of the alphabet would take me about 9 months. But I did actually feel I'd moved along a bit. And that was very satisfying. I mean, part of me has always rather liked filing systems and sorting things out and making columns and writing out vocabularies. And this part hadn't been used very much lately. So it was good fun having a go at something totally different. It was also quite sociable, which writing novels isn't. In fact, it was too sociable. I had a full-time assistant kind of living in my house because I worked at home, and she and I had lunch together every day for 5 years. But that was quite fun, being in an office situation in my own house and corresponding with people and sort of having lunches with people and, pestering everybody I knew about what to do next with the Oxford Companion, which I would never do with a novel.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to write your own entry?
I didn't have an entry.
Why not?
I didn't put myself in because I thought if I put myself in, everybody would complain and say, who does she think she is? And if I left myself out, everybody would say, why has she left herself out, which is much pleasanter for me.
But now you won't be in it until there's another edition.
Well, my assistant is actually, at the moment, I trust, compiling a 20th century companion. I said I didn't want any truck with this because it would bring me into too dangerous territory. But that will give her an opportunity to put in a lot of younger writers who were ineligible for our volume and also people like me who were on the borderline.
Mm-hmm. You are married now to the biographer Michael Holroyd, who just completed the second volume in a 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw. And he was, in fact, a guest on our program just about a week ago. And I had asked him about this, and I'd like to ask you as well. And that's about your living relationship. You live nearby but in separate houses from each other. I find that just a very interesting arrangement, and I really understand the drive for privacy, which is what I suppose is behind that arrangement. But I guess what I'd like to ask you is why get married if you're going to live separately?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I don't know if I can give you a very satisfactory answer. Did you ask Michael this?
Not in those words exactly, because I think it wasn't until after the interview that I realized that was really what my question was.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I mean, the lifestyle is absolutely fine and obviously pleasant, and a lot of people would like to do it if they had 2 houses or could afford to do it. But I mean, particularly if they married kind of later in life, as we did. But why we got married is a sort of mystery to me. I think it's something to do with the fact that Michael and I, we'd been going out together and sort of taking one another out for meals for quite a long time. But Michael and I are both very polite people and rather reserved and private people in a strange way. That's something we have very much in common. And we were so polite that we couldn't quite work out what the other person wanted all the time. And I think we thought if we got married, it would be a shortcut through a lot of that. It would be easier to cut through all that and just know that we were a couple, even if we didn't seem to be a couple or look like a couple, that on one level we were a couple and we could rely on each other in a particular kind of way. It also made it very convenient with going on lecture tours for the British Council because we could travel together. And although I missed him this time in America, quite often we do get to travel together. And it's very nice to travel together as husband and wife and be and feel that, we are accepted as a couple without people worrying about whether we're a couple or not.
Okay. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. My guest has been Margaret Drabble, and her new novel, A Natural Curiosity, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Scottish film director Bill Forsyth. His movies include Local Hero, Gregory's Girl, and Comfort and Joy. His new film, Breaking In, stars Burt Reynolds. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After getting universally panned in Revolution, Al Pacino has gotten rave reviews in the new erotic thriller Sea of Love. Coming up, we meet the man who directed him, Harold Becker. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at the new Tom Selleck movie, An Innocent Man. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of Marian Anderson recordings. It includes her debut at the Metropolitan Opera, the first time a black performer sang a leading role at the Met. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On the eve of 40th anniversary celebrations in East Germany, communist authorities have sharply cut access to East Berlin. The West German government has filed a formal protest, demanding that crossing points through the Berlin Wall be reopened immediately. And the three Western allies controlling West Berlin are demanding the Soviet Union take action as well. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Hundreds of people were turned back by East German border guards at the Berlin Wall today. Diplomatic sources say that closing the border to normal civilian traffic is a unilateral change in the city, which is specifically barred by the 1971 Quadripartite Agreement on Berlin. Officially, the United States, Britain, and France still insist that Berlin is one city, divided into four military sectors. So cutting off access to East Berlin, the Soviet sector, calls for a protest to the Soviet Union. The sources said that the Western allies are trying to put pressure on the East Germans through their Soviet allies, but are making a point to Moscow as well, saying they expect the Soviets to live up to their responsibilities and rectify what's described as a serious infringement of the four-power agreement. This is Neil Conan reporting.
Eight trainloads of East German refugees arrived in West Germany today from Czechoslovakia. Since the 11th of last month, 40,000 refugees have fled to West Germany through Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. Refugees who arrived this morning said that many of the East German stations along the rail line were occupied by security forces. A new child care package passed in the House today, similar to one approved by the Senate in June. Both houses will now work out their differences in conference committee. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
The House of Representatives today passed a child care bill that would give poor parents more money to spend on child care through earned income tax credits. It would also make more child care services available through the public schools or Head Start programs. The bill would also make sure that the states develop standards for health and safety in child care centers. The House defeated a move backed by President Bush that would have relied solely on tax credits for child care. And it rejected another Republican-supported measure that would have stripped the requirement for safety standards. The child care bill was the last piece of business in the huge deficit reduction package known as Reconciliation. Shortly after the vote on child care, the House went ahead and overwhelmingly approved the catch-all measure. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Department of Energy said today that gasoline inventories in the country went up 5 million barrels last week. This increase occurred in spite of the shutdown of a major refinery in the Caribbean damaged by Hurricane Hugo. For the third day in a row, stocks scored record highs. The Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 2.5 points in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Marian Anderson achieved an international following as a singer of both spirituals and European classical works. Anderson's classical performances are featured on a new CD that also includes several spirituals. Although it's titled Marian Anderson, Bach, Brahms, Schubert, pieces by Schumann, Verdi, Strauss, and other composers are represented as well. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review.
Contralto Marian Anderson is a very great singer. A couple of the selections on this new RCA Victor CD were made late in her career and don't show her in her very best voice. And yet the most recent selection, recorded in 1955, is extraordinary. It's the aria by Ulrika in Verdi's A Masked Ball, the part in which Anderson made her belated Metropolitan Opera debut. In fact, it was her first appearance in an opera, and the first time a black singer appeared in a leading role at the Met. The aria was recorded only 2 days after that historical event. Ulrika is the fortune teller who foresees the death of the hero, the governor of Boston. This can be a campy role in the wrong hands, but Anderson's Ulrika is a tragic figure who understands the consequences of her prediction. Here is her powerful invocation to the King of the Abyss. Anderson had a special feeling for the warmth and humanity of Brahms. Among her most moving performances is the Alto Rhapsody. Anderson recorded it at least 3 times. This new album includes her rare 1945 version with Pierre Monteux and the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus. I've never heard anyone embrace with greater breadth of voice and depth of feeling the words of the Goethe poem that Brahms sets. It's really a poem about a nervous breakdown, spoken by someone whose very isolation turns him even further away from humanity, who despises himself for his very selfishness. He prays that the Father of Love will end his hatred of mankind, Menschenhass. Psychoanalysis wouldn't be enough. Only a spiritual change can help the thirsty one in the desert turn his eyes upward to the thousand fountains of love. This album also includes Anderson's performance of one of the most mysterious of Brahms' songs, Immer leiser wird mein Schlummer, Ever lighter grows my slumber. It's another lament for loneliness and a vision of approaching death. Eugene Ormandy conducts a gloppy orchestral arrangement of the original piano accompaniment. Brahms first used the opening melody in the slow movement of his second piano concerto, where an orchestra is surely more appropriate. But when Anderson is singing, nothing else much matters. Since this album is called Bach, Brahms, Schubert, you might expect more of Anderson's other Brahms performances instead of the random sampling of other composers. Not that I'm complaining. I wouldn't part with her Handel or Schumann or with any of the spirituals, especially the chilling 1941 recording of Crucifixion, released here for the first time. Only two selections, in different versions, duplicate anything on the album issued by Pearl a few months ago. I just hope the rest of Anderson's Brahms, and everything else she ever recorded, will be made available soon.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. One of this season's hit films is the erotic thriller Sea of Love, starring Al Pacino. It was directed by my guest Harold Becker, whose other films include The Onion Field, Taps, Vision Quest, and The Boost. In Sea of Love, Pacino plays a cop investigating a serial killer whose victims have all placed personal ads in a New York weekly. To try and lure the killer, Pacino places his own ad. One of the women who responds is played by Ellen Barkin. He makes a date to meet her at a restaurant.
It was interesting you're coming from York, Pennsylvania, because in a way, you went from York to New York.
You like the park and I like the beach. You like movies, I like plays. You're a printer, I manage a shoe store. And I don't believe in wasting time on this kind of stuff. You know what you know, and you go with it.
You go with what?
You're just not my type.
I mean, just sat down, you know.
I believe in animal attraction. I believe in love at first sight. I believe in this. And I don't feel it with you.
Well, I'm hell on wheels once you get to know me, honey.
It's nothing personal.
Oh, come on. Where are you going?
I think Pacino's last movie before Sea of Love was Revolution, which was set in the Revolutionary War.
And right.
He was really criticized for playing the movie with this thick New York accent. People thought he was really in a slump. Were you confident when you took over directing this film that he'd be capable of not only a good performance, but the kind of really terrific performance he gives in the film? Oh,
I never questioned it. Never questioned it. The inspiration for my involvement in the picture was to work with Pacino, because I have felt he had this enormous talent, potential, everything. And I did feel as Pacino went, so would go the picture. I just felt he had the magic to carry it across.
Pacino has a reputation for doing a lot of takes in each scene until he's satisfied. Was that the case with Sea of Love?
Yes, to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Al is a perfectionist, and he is somebody who continuously works towards giving you more and more. In fact, you can say he also is somebody who gives you with each take something else. So it isn't a question of somebody just repeating themselves.
What are the variations like from take to take in one of his scenes?
It could be a question of intensity, a spontaneity, focus. Sometimes there was a loss of focus that he would regain in a later take. Sometimes he had it right from the first moment, and other times it was something else he was reaching for. Sometimes it was something that I was after. Another time it was something that he had in his mind that he hadn't gotten out in those takes and wanted another one for it.
If you felt satisfied with the take that he gave, but he wanted to do it again, would you defer to him?
Absolutely. I mean, within reason, of course, because it was almost like somebody saying, I have something else to say, and it would be incumbent upon you to listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a certain strategy in shooting Pacino, in getting the kind of look that you wanted from him?
Yes, I did have a strategy. I quickly came to realize that he had such an expressive face that he was able to capture so much of the nuances in the close-up that I probably use more close-ups in this film than I've ever used before. Hopefully it's not noticeable because I hopefully mix them well enough with wide shots, but I did use many more. I did a lot of close-up with Al.
Let's talk about Ellen Barkin's performance and directing her. Throughout the movie, you never know whether she's innocent or dangerous. How did you try to bring out both sides of her in that performance?
It was a very difficult role to play in that sense because it was walking a tightrope. You're very right about that. We couldn't allow her to go too soft, too warm. On the other hand, if we just took all of that out of the performance, then the love story would suffer. And so it was endlessly going back and forth, and we tried to keep a narrow line through it all.
She has a very interesting face and a very unusual face. Her nose is a little crooked. Her face is slightly asymmetrical. So when you're doing close-ups of her face, what are you looking for? What are you thinking about?
It's a very, very attractive face.
It's a gorgeous face.
That sort of broken, those broken features somehow add up to something more than maybe a more perfect face might. And within the context of this film, I think that it was a perfect face for this film. And certainly in the close-ups, I worked out camera angles, et cetera, which I thought worked best for Ellen. And we worked very, very closely with hair, makeup, et cetera, to get the quality we were after with her.
There's a very erotic scene between Pacino and Barkin in which they're both really aroused but both terribly paranoid. It's erotic but dangerous. Did you choreograph that scene?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A scene like that had to be choreographed.
Now, did you do the choreography yourself?
No, I worked it out with the actors. I had certainly came to it prepared with... I had an idea of what I was after and then worked it out with the actors.
Can you give us a sense of some of the things that you worked out in the choreographing of that love scene?
Well, it's first of all, when you're doing a love scene, it involves a certain physicalness. I don't care whether you're even just talking about a kiss, you're talking about dress, undress, how clothes come off. All of this is very physical. I mean, it all seems natural, hopefully, when one sees a film, but some of it can be very awkward, as we all know. And one wants to avoid the awkwardness. One wants things to seem spontaneous. All of that requires working out. I mean, it's working out right down to where one's arms are in a specific situation, to what side one's face goes in a kiss, you know, in terms of how it favors the camera.
I guess you don't want faces to look squashed or anything.
Of course, there's... The thing has to have almost a ballet quality to it without seeming to be stylized.
Films are often shot out of sequence. But I think in a suspense film, it's maybe even more important than in any other kind of film to shoot in sequence so that you remember what level of paranoia and suspense you're at. Did you shoot in sequence for this?
No, we didn't shoot all together in sequence, but I did try to hold back the most emotional scenes. As you say, the scenes where the paranoia was really running high, down into the middle to the end of the schedule. So that by that time, the actors are well into the film and already have a feeling. It would be awful to try to do those kind of scenes early on in the film. But in terms of having the luxury of shooting it in complete sequence, you know, no, that wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, we did pay attention to it. Yes, of course, I paid a lot of attention to that.
When you were shooting street scenes on the streets of Manhattan,
right,
were there ever real people on the streets in addition to extras?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if you remember the last scene on 57th Street where Al is walking down the street with Ellen. A pedestrian bangs into him and literally knocked him out of the shot. And
exactly.
He runs back into it.
Yeah.
That was an accident. That occurred because somebody just walked right into the shot and walked right through it. That was not planned at all. And once it happened, I knew it was going to be part of the film because Al recovered so wonderfully because he was able to take it and use it as part of his whole performance. But there's an example of... it's very hard in New York to keep people out of a scene.
Now, the first time I saw James Woods in a leading role was in The Onion Field, which you directed. And he played a cop killer in it. And it was an incredible performance. Were you involved in casting him in that role?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Why did you choose him?
Very much so. I chose him because I felt that as an actor, he simply was the best actor I could get for the part. Interestingly enough, when I was casting, another actor had come in who really was a lookalike for the actual Greg Powell. Remember, that was a true story, and
right.
These people were alive, albeit in San Quentin, but alive. And Joe at that time got very excited about using the other actor.
Because this is Joseph Wambau who wrote it.
Wambau, right. And we had to do a screen test in order to convince Joe that Jimmy was the right actor for it. And, of course, before it was over, none of us, and looking back, can even think there was another actor who could have done this.
He's got such intensity. Did you ever find you almost had to tone him down?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. He really crawled into the skin of that man. And I just ran The Onion Field with Joe the other day. We hadn't seen it in years. And we were, again, just stunned by his performance, by all the performances in it. The reality of it still came through with just unbelievable intensity.
Sea of Love has been doing quite well. How's that going to affect your career as a director, do you think? Do you now have more of a choice in what your next project will be?
The problems always remain, which is to find good material. And hopefully your dream always is there's that it will open the door to more good material, of course. But I don't have any illusions that there is some room out there that I'm now going to be given the key to in which all the good material is. It's still always a problem of finding material, developing material, and of course, there's no doubt that I'm in a better position at this point to explore certain material that might not have been available to me before.
Harold Becker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Harold Becker is the director of Sea of Love.
Come with me, my love, to the sea of love.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered, and that includes, no doubt, the story of the conviction of Jim Baker.
That's right. Evangelist Jim Baker was convicted today by a fairly unforgiving jury on all counts, and we'll have a story on that. We'll also be talking about the Dalai Lama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and why he won it. We're going to follow up on the story from Panama. We're going to go back to East Germany. The country has closed its borders completely now, preparing for the visit of Gorbachev. And we'll talk to a Czech dissident about how people in his country feel about the exodus that is taking place through Czechoslovakia.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Three Men and a Baby was the top-grossing film of 1988. One of its co-stars was hunk Tom Selleck, who also starred in the popular TV series Magnum P.I. Selleck is back in the new movie An Innocent Man. It reunites the production team that made Three Men and a Baby. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us what he thinks of the result.
So here's the premise. Tom Selleck plays the best airline mechanic the world has ever seen, and the nicest. He's married to Layla Robbins, and she's pretty and sweet, and she just loves him to death. And they're planning a vacation in Thailand, and their life is just terrific. So terrific that movie logic dictates the roof has just got to crash in, which it does. One day, two coked-up, underhanded narcotics cops mistake Selleck's home for the home of a drug dealer. They break in, shoot at and wound him, and then, to cover up their incompetence, they plant a gun on him while he's still unconscious and place bags of cocaine around his home. These evil cops get an informant to testify against him, and before our hero knows it, he's doing 6 years at the California State Pen in Oroville for assaulting an officer and dealing cocaine. Now, the screenplay doesn't take this turn of events at all well. It's not right, the characters insist. It's just not fair. After 15 minutes spent drilling these subtleties into your skull, the movie whisks us off to prison, which, as the screenplay would have it, is actually a kind of advanced boot camp. You go in a tough guy, and you come out a real tough guy. What makes a real tough guy real tough? Oh, murder, solitary confinement, and lots of conversations like this one between Selleck and a mean, ugly hombre in the prison mess hall.
You got to deal with that situation, or everybody in here is going to know you're a punk. Everybody, you understand?
You're telling me I should kill him?
No, I want you to marry his sister. You better get with the program, Slick.
I'm not going to kill a man over some toothpaste and some soap.
If you don't off that bug, then he and his partner's going to make you their kid. They're going to have you running errands, doing whatever. Hell, he might even think you're real pretty. You ain't got to stand tall in here. But you've got to stand up.
If that dialogue strikes you as more likely to have been overheard at a script conference than behind bars, you're beginning to get the picture. The director, Peter Yates, is one of those solid pros who can turn a good script into a movie like Bullet or Breaking Away. But give him a bad script and he'll make The Deep, or The House on Carroll Street, or An Innocent Man, which is swift, moderately suspenseful, and unforgivably dumb. The film piles one groaning prison picture cliché upon another, and even the premise seems pretty dopey. I mean, can we really overlook the following facts? That nobody seems to have noticed that the evil cops burst into Selleck's house without a warrant. That their only witness is a known criminal, and therefore not entirely trustworthy. That for some reason Selleck's lawyer never calls as character witnesses any of the dozens of beaming friends we've just seen praising him on the job. That despite the evil cops' well-known propensity for suspicious arrests and their long-standing mob connections, only one man in the police internal affairs department seems suspicious of them. Then in prison we get F. Murray Abraham trying to talk like Burt Lancaster. He plays a hardened but infinitely wise and tender convict who befriends Selleck and tells him things like, "Don't you be talking out the side of your neck when I'm trying to do you a solid." And we get Selleck himself, who greets his introduction to every new prison horror with a winsome pout. The screenwriter, Larry Brothers, is said to have based his script on his own prison experience. Maybe so. But when it comes to movie experience, he remains, I'm afraid, a very innocent man.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Bob Alls, and Joyce Lieberman. Our director, Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Scottish film director Bill Forsyth discusses his movies Local Hero, Comfort and Joy, and the new film Breaking In, starring Burt Reynolds. Also, Dmitry Nabokov tells about collecting the letters of his late father, Vladimir Nabokov. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.